Okay, we'll start. We're doing this book tour, Tibetan Book of Yoga, and we're going around the country, and we get many invitations to go to different places, and we never have time to go to all of them. There was a chance to come through Colorado, and this was one place that I sort of begged to come to Naropa College, you know, because you have such an extraordinary lineage. You're so fortunate to be here, and it's an honor to come to this place. So I sort of like wheedled my way into talking here. Especially the kindness of Trungpa Rinpoche, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was an extraordinary lama who brought Buddhism. I mean, you have no idea, in Tibet, to meet Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, you would have had to, you know, wait for a few years, and maybe you'd see him from a distance in a parade or something. And then these lamas had the kindness to come to the West and try to fit in with our culture, which is very difficult. You know, if he came as Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche from Tibet, you would fail in your guru yoga in about half an hour and you would split. But he took on, he mastered our customs and our, and you know, the way we live, and taught us that way. It's very kind and great, and one of the few lamas to really do that. So you're very fortunate to be here at Naropa College. Also, I think, is Venerable Michael here? No. Yeah? No. Later. Okay. Wanted to think. So I asked the lamas, what should I speak about at Naropa? They said, Naropa. So, So anyway, this is how we know Naropa. I'm from the Dalai Lama's lineage. We're Galupa lineage. And the founder of our lineage, it's a different lineage from what Chögyam Trungpa was, a Kagyu lineage. And in Tibet, they have developed separately for about 1,000 years. And Jetsun Kapa, who founded our lineage 600 years ago, was the teacher of the first Dalai Lama. So I think our experience of Naropa and your experience of Naropa coming from that Kagyu background is a little bit different. And I thought you might like to hear how we get introduced to Naropa. You know, what we have to go through in the monastery to meet Naropa. So basically, you go to a monastery when you're 7. You recite books. You learn to read and write. You memorize things. You have to memorize the books you're going to learn. So there are 5 great books you're going to learn from ancient India, and then you have to memorize them before you accept it into the classes. So you memorize these 5 great books from India, and then at the age of 13 they start to teach you debating, if you've ever seen Tibetan debating. It looks like karate, right? And it's a lot of fun, especially if you got like 1500 guys and no girls. It's good to get all your hormones out, you know, because they're going through their teens and their 20s, and it's good for people. Then at about age 15, they put you in the debate ground if you're ready, and they start formal classes. Then we spend 12 years in perfection of wisdom, which is understanding wisdom. This is like 6 to 8 hours of classes a day, 5 to 8 hours of debating a day. 2 or 3 hours of memorizing, a little bit of sleep, 3 hours of rituals in the morning. Like that. It's crazy. It's very demanding. And a lot of people drop out. It's about a 90%, 95% dropout rate before you finish in the 20 years. Then you get through the whole thing, 12 years of perfection of wisdom, 4 years of Madhyamika, middle way, and then 2 years of Abhidharma, Buddhist psychology, then 2 years of Vinaya, which is ethics, and then 20 years of logic in the winter, and 2 to 3 months in every winter in logic and perceptual theory. How do you perceive things? Then you finish, and there's a big ceremony. It's very exciting. It's 10 days long. You get examined by each of the 12 classes in the monastery, like freshman class, sophomore class. You get examined by them. They get to rip you apart in the debate round. And then the 10th night, you do a defense in front of the whole monastery. 1,300 monks can come up and ask you questions. And then the next day you go to the temple and you sing a text by memory. And no one has anything to do except listen to see if you make a mistake. And then the old abbots come, and geshes who don't go out to the debate park because it's cold or hot or it's raining. So they come up and they grill you one last time. And then they like approve you. Okay, you passed, geshe, you know. And you get this hat. And they teach you how to keep it on, because when you stand up, it falls off. There's a string that goes around your ear and back here. So then you go to your room, and there's a big party, like lots of butter tea, and everybody comes and gives you Tibetan donuts and pastries, and 3 days of just relax, you know. And then they say, well, what are you going to do now, Geshe Michael? You know, you're like, and you know, you've been doing this for 20, 25 years, and you're sort of at a loss what to do now. It's like when you graduate from college. You have this anxiety attack, right? Like, what am I supposed to do now? Now I have to feed myself, you know? Like, everyone expects me to feed myself now. And some people become teachers in the monastery. Some people go to the West to make their fortune, you know, become a lama somewhere, which is not always fun. I mean, sometimes it's like freezing in the basement of some house in Frankfurt or something while you're trying to make a Dharma center. And then some people go to Tantric College. And then you go to Tantric College. There are two great Galupa Tantric Colleges called Gyume and Gyutu. And you go to the Tantric College that your teacher went to. If your teacher deems you ready, they will introduce you to Tantra earlier than that. But there's a point, usually 2 years into the Tantric course. In my case, one of my lamas became the abbot of the Tantric monastery, Gyume Tantric Monastery, my logic teacher. And then he came, and Christy and I were able to do the whole advanced Tantric course with him, Naropa, based on Naropa's teachings, what we call the six practices or six yogas of Naropa. So we went through the whole teaching with him. Geshe Tenne Dogye, and Geshe Tupin Rinjen is one of my main teachers. And then partway into that course, here's this logic professor, you know, and I've never seen him do anything but sit on a mat and, you know, yell at us and stuff, ask us questions about syllogisms. And then he says, time to learn yoga. You know, and we're like, yoga? Yoga, you know, this is Naropa. Naropa, with Naropa, you do outside method and an inside method, you know. So the outside method is yoga. And the inside method is meditation and understanding wisdom, especially emptiness. So then we started yoga, and it was really felt weird. And then they give you an initiation into yoga, and then you have to vow that for the rest of your life, you will use outside methods and inner methods. So the outside methods are yoga and special breathing practices and other practices. And then inner methods are understanding wisdom. And this transmission all comes from Naropa. And Naropa's story, I'm sure you know Naropa's story. You're attending Naropa. But my lama said to talk about Naropa. So he was born in a royal family. He was a prince. And this is a big deal. You don't know what a king means in the old days. A king owns everything in the country, you know? You can walk into anybody's house and say, give me your cows, give me your furniture, give me your wife, give me your children. You own the people and the place, you know? You own everything. You just walk somewhere and say, I want that, and they have to give it to you. So at age 11, he says, I don't want that. I give that up. And he walks to Kashmir from West Bengal, right? This is like a 1,000-mile walk. It's like walking from here to New York City, right? And dangerous, very dangerous in those days. no police, no highway patrol. You know, somebody to mug you every mile. And he walks to Kashmir and he starts to study the inner methods, meditation and understanding emptiness. And he gets a good training for 5-6 years. Then he walks back to West Bengal. He brings back a bunch of great yogis with him, and they continue to teach him the inner methods. Then his parents are putting pressure on him to get married. And he says, no. And they said, please, I'm going to kill myself if you don't get married. You know. So he says, okay, here's like 12 things I want in a girl. If you can find one girl who has all 12, you know, I'll get married. And it's impossible. It's totally impossible. Like, she has to be, her name has to be like, well, her name, it's like your name, Nirmala. And then she has to be from a Brahmin family, and she has to have faith in the Dharma. She has to have bodhicitta. She has to have all these impossible list of things. And then, so the king sends out two ministers. They find a girl, of course, by bad luck or good luck, I don't know, who has all these qualities. And that her parents say no, because they're Brahmins and he's royal, right? So, and then the two ministers say, we're going to sit down on the porch and starve ourselves to death until you release the girl. So then they get really skinny, and then the parents let her go. And he gets married. But still, then again, after 7 years, he becomes a monk. And he enters. There's debate. I mean, some people say Nalanda, some people say Vikramashila, but one of the two great ancient monasteries. And he eventually became the gatekeeper, which was a big position. I don't know. You know, gatekeeper of Nalanda or Vikramashila. It meant that you would post a guy like that guy at the doorway, okay? And if a Baptist minister came up and wanted to convince us all to be Baptists, right? And then the gatekeeper has to debate him about, like, God, you know? And if the Baptist wins, we all become Baptists, you see? So, no, that was the custom. You know, so the gatekeeper was a very important position. If Naropa loses the debate, everybody in the monastery becomes whatever guy walked up. And it was a very serious custom. And people would, you know, like monks would have to take their robes off and start to wear some yogi's thing or something. And so he had that position. Later he became abbot of the monastery. And he became very famous. He was the greatest scholar in India. Okay. Then one day he's out... they say he's out under a tree or something, and he's reading a scripture about... He studied mainly Asangas, Maitreya's books. He's known to have studied the five great books of Maitreya and the six great books of Nagarjuna. So he covered bodhicitta and emptiness together. And reasoning. Rikthok Duk of Nagarjuna was his specialty. So logic. He studied logic, and he studied emptiness. And he studied Asangas' presentation of mind only. And of course he was a Vinaya scholar. He knew ethics and Abhidhamma. So he had the basic training that you would get in any major Tibetan monastery. So he's been through the whole spiel. He's out memorizing some new book. He's an abbot already. An old woman comes up to him. And she's like a bag lady, you know. And she's like a homeless person, you know. And she comes up. And he's like the president of Harvard or something, okay. No, it's like a big deal, like a wealthy thing, you know. Lots of sponsors, kings, you know, and of Nalanda. And then she says, what are you doing? And he says, oh, I'm the abbot. I'm memorizing a book, you know. This is a book about Buddhist philosophy, you know. And she says, well, do you understand it? You know, and he says, well, sure, I understand it, you know. And she says, the words or the meaning, you know. And he says, well, I understand the words. I'm reading it. And she does this beautiful dance, you know, this Dakini dance. And she's very happy. And she says, oh, great, I'm so happy, you know. And she says, do you understand the meaning also? And he says, yeah, I do. And then she starts crying and tearing out her hair and her clothes and spitting. And then he says, wait, why did you start dancing when I said I understand the words? And now you're having like a hysteria attack when I said I understood the meaning. She says, well, when you understand the words, I thought you meant you only understood the words and not the meaning. So I was happy because I met a monk who told the truth, you know? And then And then when you added that you knew the meaning as well as the words, I knew you were lying. You know? So I got upset. Well, what do you want? And then she says, then he says, well, who understands the words if I don't? And she says, Talopa. Who's Talopa? Talopa's my brother. Well, bring him here and have him teach me the meaning then, you know. Then she says, you don't ask your guru to come to you. You go beg the guru, and she disappears, you know, like that. And then he goes off, you know, he goes back to the monastery. I can't even imagine where his mind was at. I can't even imagine, you know. I mean, where would you be at that point? He's already famous. He's set for life. He has tenure, right? And now he has everything. And there's no reason to go anywhere. You know, he's very well respected. He's very famous. Everything's going for him, you know. And he just decides to leave and go look for this guru, Talopa, you know. And it's amazing. So I think it's a kind of courage that we all need. You see, I mean, we need to be willing to give up what seems to be very firm and very, you know, stable. And just when something comes up of great meaning, we have to be willing to leave in a day. We have to be available to leave on the spot if Vajrayogini shows up and says, come. Then you just go. You see what I mean? So he told everybody, I'm leaving, you know. And he took off his robes and he put on this... you see pictures of him. We're going to do a talk on the weekend. And there's a carvings of him. He's just wearing this this loincloth like that, yeah. And he just puts on this white loincloth. Like, and then he says, I'm leaving, you know. And there's a big scandal. You know, all the monks are angry. And like 500 monks are like cursing him, you know. And the king comes and says, I command you to stay. And he says, I can't. I have to go look for my guru. Guru, you've had like 100 gurus. What do you need another one for? And he says, I'm going, you know. It's my real... And then he just left. And everybody hated him. Everybody said bad things about him. And he left. And he just wandered through the forest. And then he gets all these tests. Talopa gives him all these tests. 12 great tests. And tests, you know, when you read these tests in a book, it sounds like, oh, you know what's going to happen at the end. So you don't worry about them so much. So, you know, Guru says, jump off the roof. And it's a test, you see. He's not sure he should jump off the roof, but he jumps, you know. And then he's like down there all hurt, and Talopa comes down as another person, right? And what are you fool? Why'd you jump off the roof? He's stupid, you know. And then, no, and it sounds funny, and when you read the 12 tests, they don't seem like tests much, because you're like, oh, I know he's going to do it anyway. And at the end, he gets Talopa. We know the ending. So it's not much of a test, really. But we get those tests all the time. Okay, especially if you're close to a lama, you know. Their job, the dynamic. And it's not coming from them. It's coming from the blessing of the guru-disciple relationship. It's not them, like, trying to think of how to torture you, you know. Although it may seem like that, you know. It's the magic of that dynamic. That magic always happens when a disciple is pure. Then there's always this testing going on. So what I mean to say is that, you know, those tests sound easy, and you think that the crisis you're having is not one of those tests. Couldn't be a lama test, but it is a lama test. Okay, whatever crisis you're having right now, or last year or next year, it doesn't matter. The lamas are preparing you. It's a blessing. And Trungpa Rinpoche certainly, I've met many of his older students, and he gave them impossible tests. And I have the pleasure to be around the ones who did what he asked them. And they're extraordinary people now. They're like unbelievable people now, you know. So, lama's test. So I like the ending of the test. After the 12th test, Talopa still hasn't shown up. And Naropa decides to kill himself, you know. So that's a very bad deed in Buddhism. You see, to kill another being or to kill yourself is the same thing. In Buddhism, we don't distinguish. Suicide and murder are the same thing. To deprive someone else of their holy vehicle and deprive yourself of the same thing is just as serious. So here's the greatest abbot, the greatest scholar of ancient India, and he's got a knife to his wrist, and he says, I can't find Talopa, I give up, you know? And he's going to kill himself. And then Talopa appears, you know? He says, now you're ready, you know? So, you know, they test you up to that point, okay? That's their job. Just if it ever happens to you, you'll know. Then they appear. And it will happen if you keep going. So then he grants him two great... he grants him many tantras, secret teachings. And I don't know if you appreciate that almost all the tantras in Tibet came through Naropa. You know, like Kalachakra, that His Holiness teaches, Hevajra, Vajrayogini, Mahamudra, Naropa's six practices, all of these secret practices, they're all like funneling through Naropa, you know. So he's really extremely kind to us, great teacher. I don't know if you Galupas appreciate, he was Atisha's teacher, Lord Atisha's teacher, okay? So he taught, you know, the person who is really the grandfather of the Galupas was taught by Naropa, perfection of wisdom and tantra. Okay, so at Nalanda, and then Naropa became the abbot. I'm sorry, Atisha became the abbot. So anyway, there are two great transmissions that come down to our generation from Naropa in our monasteries. And that's the six practices of Naropa, which are very, very secret in our tradition. They never teach them to more than two or three people at a time, maybe one, two people at a time. It's not an open tantra that you give initiation openly. When we received it, it was only two people. And that's the way they do it. And you don't even know in the monastery who has that for 20 years. They don't show it, and you don't know. And then Jetsun Kapa wrote a very beautiful commentary. The teacher of the first Dalai Lama wrote a very beautiful commentary, and that's where we trace our yoga lineage back to. The physical exercises of our tradition started with Naropa, then went down through Marpa. Chakrasambhara is supposed to have taught Tilopa. The Tilopa taught Naropa. Naropa taught this Tibetan businessman named Marpa. Okay, he was known, he was a paunchy guy, he was a big fat guy, and he was interested in business. He owned agriculture businesses, you know, huge. And he went to Tibet, to India, it was almost like a business in those days. And like you exchanged gold for knowledge, and then you came back and set up your Dharma center and charge people, and it was like that. And so Marpa came back, brought it. His disciple was Milarepa. His disciple was Gampopa. And then his disciple was Parmodupa. And then Parmodupa wrote a series of teachings, he wrote down the physical asanas that we do in the Galupa tradition. And then Jetsun Kapa learned them from the Digung Kagyu lineage. So that's how we get the physical exercises. And they're very closely kept in the monastery, very closely kept. So we learned them, and then we came back, and we were going to do a three-year retreat to sort of master that whole practice of the six yogas of Naropa. And before going into retreat, we were discussing, like, maybe we should have some other kind of exercise, like fun exercise. Because, like, to sit on your butt for 3 years in a hut in the desert is sort of weird. And we thought we'd get in fights and stuff. Because it's like 100 degrees in the day and it snows at night. So it's a long time, you know. So she talked me into going. She said, let's go to a yoga center. Actually, we decided to go learn to dance, Indian dance. And then... there was a problem, the time wasn't right, they didn't have the right thing. And then she said, let's go to yoga. I said, I don't want to go to yoga, you know, they'll have all this Hare Krishna music going, and they'll have a big Ganesh statue out front, and they'll be worshipping this elephant nose guy, and there'll be flowers and incense, and I just don't feel comfortable, you know. And then she said, no, let's just try, I've been there before, you know, like many years ago. So I said, okay, just out of respect, I'll go try once, you know. And then, I don't know if you know Jiva Mukti Yoga, but we went to Jiva Mukti Yoga in New York. And David Life was there, who I think is like, I don't know, one of the greatest yogis in America. And so he looked, the elevator opens up, and there's Ganesh staring at me right in the face. You know? I remember. And I'm like, I told you, look, you know, there's all these New Age books. There's people going, oh, you know, chanting Krishna chants. And I'm like, man. And I said, I want a private class, you know. I don't want anybody to see me here. Because all my students are around there, you know. And so they said, $150 for private. I'm like, I'll take it. You know, and everybody else is paying $15, you know. So so we get a private class. David comes in. And he taught us. And after half an hour, I'm like, this is really weird, you know. This is exactly the same yoga they taught us in the monastery, you know. This is the same asanas that we learn in the monastery, with a little exceptions, okay? A little bit different, but it's obviously the same lineage, you see. And I'm like, this is really weird. And I was sort of felt cheated, you know, because I spent 25 years to get permission to do this yoga. And now all these kids from NYU are paying $15 and they just get it, you know? And we went back to the lamas and we asked them, what's going on, you know? This is big secret stuff. And 20 million American people are doing it, you know? And what do you think about that, you know? Don't you feel like kind of improper? You want them to say, oh, that's all wrong, you know? You want them to say, oh, that's really bad, you know? They can't be doing it right. But the reaction was very interesting. They said, so 20 million people in your country have been yogis in their past lives, you know? And they said, this is an extraordinary event in the history of this world, you know? So I'm like, yeah, 20 million housewives are yogis in their past lives? And they said, yeah, they are. And not one past life, like thousands of past lives. These people went through the whole course, like Naropa, like you do in a monastery in Tibet. And then maybe after 20 years they studied yoga. And then they did special prayers, and then they went into the bardo, right? They died, left this body. And they've done that for many, many lifetimes. And now they're born into a country together. And you forget, right? I mean, many people, most normal people forget. The bardo is a very traumatic experience, and you forget where you were. Most of the, what do you call it? There's RAM and there's storage memory, right? Most of the RAM is wiped. And then only certain parts of the storage are there. And then Bhaktak Sepa is this thing where something happens in your life. And you get the seed gets triggered from your past life. So you wake up, you're born as a baby, you go through your first 15, 20 years. And normally around 20 or 30, usually 20 in the case of a Thukhu, in the case of a reincarnated Lama like Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. A big Rinpoche will... That process will happen between the age of 10 and 20. They will fully link into what they were before. And you see it in the monastery. Like those of you who know Gelugpa Lamas, Pabongka Rinpoche is in my house. So there are 12 houses in my monastery. And Pabongka Rinpoche, the third one, is in my house. And he's the big Lama in our house. And he's like the biggest goofball in our house, too. You know, I'm not supposed to tell anybody, right? But in the debate, like he's the worst guy. He just sits, like if we're all debating, he's over there and he's like taking snuff, you know? Like the debate master turns his back and there's this whole wave. You know how in a stadium everybody goes like this? But in the monastery there's this, you know? And then everybody's doing snuff. The debate master's going like this way. And then there's this thing going behind him, you know? And then when he turns back this way, it's all like... You know, and so Pabongka Rinpoche is like that, because he's the biggest Rinpoche in the monastery, you know. Nobody can tell him he's a bad boy, right? And he didn't study, and nobody wanted to get teamed up with him, because he just wasted time. And then something happened. He had an attendant from his two lives before, from Tibet, the first Pabongka Rinpoche. And he was a very beautiful man, great man. Called Gikula, and one time he and Rinpoche were going to hear His Holiness speak in North India. So it's a long train ride. It's like 1,000 miles, 500 miles. And Gikula stepped out to get something to eat for Rinpoche, and when he stepped back on the train, he slipped, and he fell between the train and the platform. And then his ribs got crushed, but he didn't die. And he got back on the train, and he delivered this food to Rinpoche, It took him like 4 hours to die. And he gave Rinpoche instructions about what to do. And then the bhavchak, the seed opened. You see what I mean? In Rinpoche's mind. And we all saw it, like it was extraordinary. Like the next week he's like leading these extraordinary tantric rituals in the monastery. And we're like, how did he learn this stuff? If you know Torgak, it's where you take these big effigies out to the fields and you burn them in special tantric protection. And then he's going to Tibet and teaching 10,000 people at a time, you know. Like just the seed cracks open, you see what I mean? So these lamas are telling me, all these American people, 20 million people. I saw a Harris poll this week. 37 million Americans are suddenly doing yoga, you see. This is a high tantric practice, you know. And the seed is cracking open, you see. So to the lamas, it's a wonderful event. It's like a historical event. And I'm like, come on, there weren't even 6 million yogis in Tibet. How could there be 20 million? You know, they said, no, bardo is a different thing. Bardo is like interplanetary travel, right? No, I mean, it's totally irrelevant what planet you're on when you die and what planet you go. You know, bardo is like faster than the speed of light. So you just, bardo is for traveling to your new life. So, and it's at the speed of thought. So, yeah, they were quite adamant. You know, here's my logic professor. Here's my tantric abbot. And he's like, yeah, 20 million people have been high yogis. And if you're going to a college named Naropa, if you even got here, you're already a high yogi from your past life. So really the college would be for waking up that seed in you like it did with Pavonkar and Pache. You see, really the purpose to be here would be to open up that seed in you. And then you just, you know, you would go straight into higher practices, you see. Very exciting, actually, to be here. So, what do I have to offer you? We Galupas are kind of boring. We don't do great meditation, and we're not great retreat masters, and we don't have wonderful rituals and stuff like that. But we got emptiness teachings, you know? So I thought to do that. I thought to just, you know, what I could contribute. You have extraordinary lineage. You have an extraordinary teachers. You come from amazing. You don't need much. But the way they teach us emptiness is really beautiful. And I think that would really be good for you. I think it would open a seed. I think it would, like, help open that seed. You know what I mean? So I'll just throw that at you. And then I thought Christy Thar could talk a little bit about... She's like a really great master about the inner. She's worked a lot on the inner body, the chakras, channels, how yoga affects your body on the inside. And where does the understanding of emptiness and on the inside, and then yoga practices on the outside, where do they meet in you? You see what I mean? Where is it where they cross over in you? And they really crack open that seed. You see what I mean? If you, chinang tabla torbe, if you work from the inside, and then you work from the outside, you get this. The seed is like super cracked open. You see what I mean? If you work from both sides. And that's a tantric vow. When we enter the monastery, the tantric monastery, we have to pray, we have to promise to work from the inside and the outside now. So it's no more just inside stuff. Now you have to work on the outside, from the outside. So she's going to talk about that. So I get to teach you emptiness, and then she's going to do that. When I went to the monastery, they gave me a little room. And they sat me down, they gave me a Tibetan rug, and they gave me, you know, a little table, and they said, you put your shrine here, you make your, you put all your lamas here, pictures. And then the lama, the head lama came in, who became later the abbot of Serame. He said, you sit here. You know, I knew like 100 words of Tibetan, you know. He's like, you sit here. You meditate. Emptiness, you know. Okay. And then he leaves, you know. And I'm like, you know, and I'm like trying to think about black, you know, something black, you know. So next day I go back and he says, how did you do? How did you do? You know, and I'm like, good meditation. And he said, well, what's it like? And I said, black. And he said, totally wrong. Go back, do again, you know. So I went back, and this time I heard something where you're not supposed to think about anything, right? So I sat down and tried not to think about anything, you know. And then I went back, and he said, next day, you know, how meditation? And I said, good. And he said, what do you do? Black? No black. I did not thinking about anything. You know, he said, but when you're trying to think about not thinking about anything, you're still thinking about something, right? And then he says, go away, you know. And then, it was like a long time. And then it took me, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years. And I remember the day I got it. I remember. You never, never ask a question in a class unless the teacher, says, you, what do you think? You never interrupt the teacher. Never. Like, you could get hit with, you know, rosaries, you think they're for counting prayers? You know? Now you hear this thing. You hear this thing, you hear, whoosh, 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 whoosh. Then you hear this, and then you're like, then you see your friend at lunch and they got these red dots across, you know, and you're like, yeah, you got the rosary. Sometimes they give you a fan belt. Like, if you really interrupt the teacher, they, like, three guys hold you down and they pull your robes up and they give you a fan belt on your bottom, you know. And if you've been really disrespectful. But anyway, I don't do that to my students. I'd like to, but there's laws in this kind of. But anyway, so anyway, I remember the day I got it and I'm like, he said something about emptiness and it just hit me. And I said, you mean it's that? You know, he says, you got it, you know, and I was so excited. And so this is all this. Who's got a pen? You got a pen? Yeah. Just throw it up here. That's okay. Yeah. And they hold up a pen. So it's not like, you know, I struggled for years. And then afterwards I felt almost bitter that they hadn't just explained it to me. You know, no, and I know they were really trying. And I just felt frustrated afterwards. I felt like, I wish someone had just explained to me what I'm explaining to you in the next 5 minutes, okay? So this is all you need to know about emptiness. No, and it's very clear and it's very easy and it's very profound. You can see why Naropa had to study that for 20 years before he got the tantric practices, you see? That's what the 20 years is for, you know? And if you know this, then yoga works. And if you don't know this, then it doesn't work. Okay, so anyway, here it is. What is this? It's a pen, right? Somebody said pen. And then if a dog came in here, I'm sorry if you heard this 200 times, but it's good luck to hear it more times. So if a dog came in here, like we had a dog this morning named Diamond, a German, big German shepherd. But if they come in here and you wave this in front of the dog, I'm going to start bringing a dog with me. But it has to be one, you know, you wave it at them and then they go, right? They go, and they take it, and then start chewing on it. So put your mind in the dog's mind. You know, imagine how the dog, they see this same thing, and you wave it in front of them, and then their reaction is not to write a poem to their dog girlfriend, right? Like, they're like, chew. You know, their reaction is chew. And try to put your mind in the dog's mind, right? They don't see it the way you see it, right? I mean, when I hold this up to the dog, the immediate reaction is like saliva comes out. No, they do, and they're like, gotta chew on it, you know? And so to a dog, this is something to chew on. It's a stick to chew on, right? It's a chew toy. And to the human, it's, you know, I just hold it up, and I may ask you, and you may be too lazy or sleepy to say it's a pen, but you knew what it was, right? I just held it up, and you were like, pen, okay, I know it's a pen. I wonder when he's going to stop. So there's two different ways of looking at this, you know? And then the big question is, which one is right? Which one is right? In the monastery, if you don't answer fast, you get rosary. You're too far away. I don't even have a rosary. Yeah. I can improvise. Which one is this? They go like this. Which one is this? No, which one's right? So it's not a pen.
Both right.
I say both. How about, let's go both. That's kind of safe, I think. Yeah. No, I mean, and the human will get unreasonable, really, and say, stop chewing on my pen. And if the dog could talk, they'd say, stop trying to write with my chew toy, you see? No, you see? And it's only some kind of prejudice. It's a prejudice that we have. It's a pen. But it's just as much a chew toy, right? I mean, that's all. So to a dog, it's a chew toy. And to a human, it's a pen. And now here's the emptiness part. Which one is it really? No, but if I say that, which one is it really? You see? Then what do you say? Is it can be two things at once. Really? When I say really. No, and it's the really thing. You see, that's how you get to emptiness. That's all. That's all. I had a guy who fell for this in Gainesville, in the bookstore. He was sitting right there, and he said, but its true function is a writing, you know? And I'm like, come on, you know? No, and the true function, there is no true function. Get it? That's all. That's emptiness. So between the chew toy that the dog sees and the pen that I see, what's the real standard thing? Standard reality, you see? What's the true use of this object? It's nothing. Nothing, honey, you know? It's just nothing, you see what I mean? And that's emptiness, okay? That's emptiness. But what's that got to do with us, you see what I mean? So, like a lama can present that to you, and you understand it, and it's not a big deal, you know? So how's it supposed to save your life, you know? How's it supposed to get you enlightened? What's the use of thinking that? And by the way, this bypasses all that stuff about don't think about nothing, or try to imagine something black, or really some forms of the clear light idea. Like try to think about a light. Some people say green light, some people say yellow light. It's not really that. If you think about it, if I say, how does the dog, imagine how the dog sees this. Close your eyes, and you think chew, you know? Then I say, imagine how the person sees this, and you think writing something, right? And then I say, take away how the human sees it. Take away how the dog sees it. What do you got? I won't pick on you anymore. What do you got?
Nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing. That's emptiness. That's all. Emptiness is the absence of something, okay? It's just something that's not there. In Tibet, they'll often say, is there a two-headed purple 38-foot elephant rampaging through this audience right now? And people say, they'll laugh and they'll say no. And they'll say, well, that's a kind of emptiness, you see? That's the absence of the elephant. Why did you pick a two-headed purple 38-foot elephant? Why didn't you just pick a regular elephant? The emphasis is on something's not there that couldn't have been there anyway. You see what I mean? It's not something's not there that could have been there. It's something's not there that was never there anyway. The real use of this object, the true use of this object, it just doesn't exist. There's no such thing. It's a two-headed purple 38-foot elephant. It just doesn't exist. So if I ask you, you know, you haven't looked behind you. Don't look behind you. You haven't looked behind you for like 20 minutes or something since we talked about the door guard, right? So do you know there's not an elephant behind you? I mean, there could be a baby elephant, right? Somebody could have snuck it in. No, really. So you don't, you know, if I said, is there any little tiny baby elephant in the room that might have got snuck in here by one of my assistants, you know, in the last 2 minutes while you were laughing? It's a possibility, right? Logically, you have to say it's a possibility. But if I say, is there a two-headed 38-foot purple elephant behind you? You don't even look around, you see? It's just not there. And that's what the real thing in my hand is that. Now, what's that got to do with my life? You see, that's the second big question. I think a lot of lamas come into town for the weekend and they talk about emptiness and then they leave before they get to the punchline. And then you're just wondering if things are real for 6 months, you know? And you just feel sort of, well, what am I supposed to do with that? You see, I mean, am I still supposed to pay my tuition, you know? Or is it unreal, you know? Is it just an illusion, you know? And no, I mean, what? Okay, I understand the thing about the pen, but what's it got to do with my life? You see, I mean, and that's... She's going to do that. You want to do that? She's going to do that. Okay. What's it got to do with your life? She's going to go for that.
The thing about the pen, the thing about this object, which appears to us as a pen, now, in front of our, before our eyes, because of the karma that we collected in the past, is the same thing as the body that we perceive. right? So it's all due to these karmic seeds, these seeds that we planted in the past. And just as with a very, very small shift in perception, you could 5 minutes from now be seeing this as a chew toy and no longer be able to see it as a pen. It happens that fast, you know? Like, death is not death is not what we think it is. Death is like a shift in perception. Your mind suddenly changes. Your mind suddenly loses its ability to see it in an upright position, and suddenly you're seeing it horizontally. Suddenly you're seeing it as something to grasp with your teeth instead of your hand, you know? And that's what it is to be a dog, is to see this as a chew toy and not a pen, you know? It's not that you have, like, four legs and fur and a tail. It's your perception of yourself. It's your perception of your own mind and your own body, right? So we've been going around the country talking about what Geshe-la mentioned earlier, Chinang Tabla Tsor Bet. We're working from the outside to affect the inside, and working from the inside to affect the outside. And it all has to do with this pen, right? And it all has to do with Naropa and his six yogas and the yoga of that's happening in America today. You know? So we want to change our body. We don't want to have a body that slowly gets older and older, and you get more and more pains, and eventually, you know, it always fails you, and eventually you have to die, and then you lose all the memory, all your RAM, and you have to start all over. All those people who are going to the yoga classes now, they don't remember all that tantric stuff that they learned in the past. And it's so frustrating, right, to have to keep starting almost from the beginning again. And we don't want that to happen. We want to achieve enlightenment in this life, right? We want to get somewhere in this life that we can take to the next life, or we want to just finish it in this life, you know? We want to turn this skin and bone into a perception of something that's no longer fallible. That's no longer able to experience any kind of pain. We want to turn our bodies into light beings. And we want our minds no longer to be tormented by angry thoughts or selfish thoughts. We want our minds to be pure. We want our minds to be these blissful minds of people who go around helping other people all the time. You know? I mean, imagine what that would be like if you never thought of yourself. Once during the day, you only thought of helping other people, and it just continually created a blissful state of mind for you. It's hard to imagine because we're so far from it. But this is the idea of working from the outside to affect the inside, and working from the inside to affect the outside, using this knowledge that we have that our bodies are just like that pen. Our bodies are empty, and we can change them. We have the ability to change them. So where does the body and the mind meet? Someone says, did this. She didn't say anything, she just did this. In the Tibetan system, we say it meets in what we call the inner body, or the channels. The outside body, there are channels that form inside your body when you're born in the womb. And the outside body actually forms around these channels. The outside body is shaped the way it is because of the formation of the channels. The inner body looks a little bit like what you see the nervous system looks like in those little drawings with all the lines and stuff. And that's the reason the nervous system looks the way that it does, because it's formed around the inner body, the channels. And these channels are very, very subtle physical things. But they're so fine, they're so subtle, that a normal human eye wouldn't be able to perceive it if you cut the body open. They are subtler. It's like as much more subtle as light is to a brick. That's how much more subtle these little inner channels are to light. But we compare them to light because there's nothing in our physical world that we can compare them to. Unless you're a really good meditator and you've already experienced them. So these are running through our body. And inside these channels is an inner wind, or prana in Sanskrit, or lung in Tibetan. And this inner wind is connected with our breath. It is not the breath. It's not the wind of our breath. The breath is much more gross, rough form. But it's connected to it. So, and the channels are connected to the body in the way that the body is shaped and the way the body moves. So with an outside sort of physical yoga practice, which is geared towards moving the body and focusing on the breath, you could affect these inner channels. Now, why would we want to do that? The inner channels are intricately connected to our thoughts. They're totally entwined with our thoughts. The prana and the thoughts are like a horse and a rider on a horse. And the thoughts ride on a wind. And when the thoughts aren't the ones in control, the prana directs the thoughts. And when the thoughts are in control, it's like the rider actually pulling the reins and directing the horse. So either one can affect the other. And in particular, there are these three main channels that run. The first channel runs down the middle of the body. And everybody here knows about this main channel. Have you heard about it before? It's called the central channel, or the Sushumna in Sanskrit, or the Uma in Tibetan. There's actually many, many names for it. And it runs exactly where your spine runs, and that's the reason the spine was formed, is because of that channel. And then it curves up around your head and ends here, and it curves down around here and ends at your perineum. And then there are two side channels that run right next to it. And at certain points, and they run all the way down alongside this central channel. But at certain points, like here, and here, and here, and here, and here, do you guys recognize these pots? They're what people call the chakras, right? Certain points, these other two side channels, they loop around the central channel like this. And they constrict it. They actually choke it off. And there's a certain amount of prana that's running in your body. And it's either running in the side channels or it's running in the central channel. And what we want is we want our prana to run in the central channel. Why? Because the central channel is where all of our beautiful, holy thoughts of helping others are, and all of our thoughts about wisdom, all of our understanding about this pen thing, everything, it runs in the central channel. Then on the two side channels, the right side is where all of our anger thoughts run, all of our irritation. From very, very slight, it's too hot in the room, up to like full on blowouts, you know. And on the left is all of our selfish thoughts of wanting things for ourselves and being willing to hurt other people or push other people out of the way to get them, you know. From, you know, taking the last, he always likes to say, taking the last maple donut when you know someone behind you might want it. up to, you know, I don't know, cheating someone out of $1 million or something like that. That's all running down in the left channel. And the thing is, when your thoughts and therefore your prana are running in one of these two side channels, when it loops around the central channel, the prana makes the channel bigger. So the picture like a straight line here, and then there's two, and they're sort of like loosely bound around here. But when they get fatter, they actually constrict the central channel. So the more prana you run through these side channels, the less you're able to have those holy thoughts, and the less you're able to understand these things. So the outside physical yogas, part of which Naropa taught in his six yogas of Naropa, which we study, is geared to work from the outside in, to work on moving the body and using the breath to push, like forcefully almost, push the prana from the outer two channels into the central channel. And then what we mean by working from the inside out is you forcefully put your mind on something like this pen thing. And you sit down and you meditate and you try to grok it. You try and grasp it as best that you can. Or you do some sort of meditation on loving kindness, on Tonglen. Does everybody know what Tonglen is? Some people do, some people don't. But it's a meditation on opening your heart and on giving to others and practicing compassion. And you just forcefully put your mind there, and that moves the winds into the central channel, working from the inside out. And the more you are able to put the winds into the central channel, the more you start experiencing your body and your mind in a completely different way. You know, your body starts to get lighter feeling, and you start to need less material sustenance to sustain it, like less food or less sleep. You don't ever feel any pain in it anymore. And it just goes gradually like that. Then suddenly you're able to start doing things like moving the elements with your body, because you come to this understanding that your body is not this solid flesh and blood thing that you always thought that it was. It's a changeable thing. It's a completely transformable thing, and all you have to do is keep working on your practices, and it will transform before your very eyes, you know? And then in your mind, you just start to have more and more holy thoughts, more and more thoughts of helping others, and then more and more thoughts about this. And the more you are able to understand this, the faster the process works of transforming yourself. Of our great, I like to say it's our great evolution. It's what we always were born to evolve into, is these light beings. You know, we weren't born to sit around in these dull old bodies forever. You know, we have a job to do. We have something to transform into. We have to become the butterfly or something. You know, I mean, it's our job. It's our job as the beings that we are now to work towards these light beings so that we can truly help other people.
Yeah.
That's all.
So the reason you do yoga in the monastery, they'll check you. They have the rosary test, you know? Like you're in the middle of an asana, right? And they'll check you and they'll say, are you working on all five levels? And you can't lie, right? Or you get double rosary. So you know, they say, are you working on your body? That's obvious. Everybody can see that, right? And are you working on your breath? They can see that. And if you do those two nicely, then it affects the prana, which is the third level. So like if you twist to the left, you're actually stretching out this channel here that carries negative wanting thoughts, okay? So like you might do a twist to the right would affect that left channel. And that's why you do yoga. That's what yoga's for. Then if you go to the other way, it would affect the anger channel. And you'd be less angry. You'd be trying to to loosen that channel. Okay? And chakras, if they loosen up, then your emotions loosen up. Then the middle channel can flow more openly. And so the whole thing of yoga and moving your body was meant to release these choke points. And what you call chakras are really choke points. When there's enough pressure on that channel as you're forming in your mother's womb, then channels start to get pushed out to the side, like horizontally. Like at the heart, you have eight channels are pushed out in the eight directions. Then if you look down on a person from the top of their head, you would see like a wagon wheel, you see? There would be eight spokes going out, and that was called a chakra, or a wheel. And in Tibetan, it's korlo, which means like a wagon wheel. So the idea is to solve the chakras and to loosen release the chakras. And what happens if you get all the prana moving into the middle channel, which is what yoga, especially heart yoga, Tibetan heart yoga, what it was meant to do. If you get all the prana moving in this channel, then two great transformations take place. One is physical, one is mental. Physically. And sometimes when you're really excited about something, you feel this like that, you know. They say the central channel only cracks open twice in a normal person's life. One is when they die. The chakras release for a minute before you move into the bardo. Then blood comes out of your nose, urine is released, feces is released, and you get this thing like this, and then the mind is gone. You see what I mean? Because the central channel just opened a little bit. The second time in a normal person's life is during sex, at the point of orgasm. And there's this slight, like this, you see what I mean? And then it's gone. And then it all closes back up tighter, you see what I mean? So we don't practice that as a method, you see what I mean? But it just to get a feeling for what would happen physically, if that channel were open all the time, like the most pleasant experience you ever had physically, is opening it maybe 0.1%. And if you do yoga properly, you open it 100%. You see what I mean? Whoa. Okay. Sort of like that. No, and then you get this, the body begins to change. And in the old days, they would take a knitting needle and they would stick your arm with it to see how light the body is getting. You see what I mean? And during a regular hour and a half of Ashtanga yoga or something, and you come out feeling great, the reason is that you've just cracked them open slightly, you see what I mean? Just a tiny bit. And that's why 20 million people are addicted to yoga, just to have that feeling. That's why 200 million people are addicted to sex. And I'm not kidding. Just to have the feeling of the channel opening slightly is addictive, because that's what you were supposed to do with your life, you know? You're supposed to open that channel. That's what we were meant to do in this world. Why? Because when it opens the whole way and you get this, you live like that. You know what I mean? Then the body changes into something like diamond, better than diamond. Okay? Then this weird things happen where you can be in many places at one time, helping many people. When the heart chakra opens, which comes before the central channel opens all the way, the first time you have the experience of the heart chakra opening, you have a vision, okay? Something happens to you. And in one moment, you can see every living being that exists, okay? And I'm not just talking people. And I'm not just talking people in Boulder, Colorado. You know, no, you see all the people who live everywhere in the world, plus every other living creature, from amoebas down to whatever, you know, whales. You see them all face to face. And not just this planet, but countless planets. So try to imagine that for a second. You know, just try to imagine that you're meditating one day, you studied hard, you practiced hard, you studied the pen thing. This is crucial. This is crucial. And then the heart chakra opens. And you did your yoga. Then this chakra opens. And then you have this like 5-minute thing where you see every single living creature on every planet. You see? And that's what they call bodhicitta, okay? So bodhicitta doesn't mean being a nice guy. Bodhicitta doesn't mean, you know, friendly. Bodhicitta means real bodhicitta, you have seen every living being that exists. And you know that for the rest of your life, which is endless according to Buddhism, right? You will serve them. You'll just take care of them. It's like being the mom of every single living thing. You know what I mean? And you can do it then, because you have this capacity. Yoga was meant to change your body into many bodies. So, that's your big dream, you see? I said today, we had a talk in a bookstore where they had pizza and ice cream. People want pizza and ice cream on this level, right? Right around here, you want pizza and ice cream. And then, a little deeper, you want sex, you know? And then, a little deeper than that, you want get famous? Or security? You want money? Place to stay? Right? I don't know, you work down. Down about here, you want to be the mother of two or three kids. That's enough. I'll devote myself to two or three people. I'll sacrifice my life for two or three people. There's a deep urge in people, right? And then below that, way down deep inside of all of us, is this inescapable urge to take care of every living creature, you know? Regardless of whether they're your kid or not. You see what I mean? There's this urge, bigger than pizza, bigger than ice cream, bigger than sex or fame or money or house or kids, which are all good. They're all nice. You'll get them. They will come automatically. But when you open this chakra with yoga and with this thing, you see, then you see all of them, and then your whole life changes. Then you don't want to do anything else for the rest of your life. Nothing. All you want to do is take care of people. And that's what people really want to do, you know. So if you are all yogis who have spent thousands of lifetimes at Tantra College, really, seriously, I mean, believe it or not, okay? I don't see why you shouldn't believe it, but maybe you're just brainwashed by your culture, right? Maybe you're brainwashed into thinking you're a normal person, right? Maybe I'm right. Maybe everybody else is wrong, you see? Maybe you are a high yogi. Maybe you have done this in many, many lifetimes. Maybe you are hearing tonight what you were meant to do, and you know it. Deep down, you know it. Maybe I got to the seed, right? Then it's very wonderful to do these practices, learn them properly, study, and learn the right practices, and then come to that point, you know? Because what you really want to do, that's why in all the movies, you know, Neo in The Matrix, he's trying to save the whole world, right? And Frodo, is it Frodo or Bilbo? I forget. Frodo in this generation. He is saving the Shire and everybody else too, you know? Like, that's why you're attracted to those movies, okay? It wasn't that those movies were made and you went and watched them. Your heart chakra created those movies. Get that. She said that your body forms around your chakras, right? When you're in the womb. So your blood vessels and your nerves and your skeleton form around the inner channels. But get this, then the world forms around that. Okay? The highway system in Denver and Boulder formed around your channel. The shape of the Rocky Mountains, if you live near them, formed around your spine. You see? The people you meet are a reflection of your channels. You see? And when you open them, then you see everybody as tantric deities. You see? Everybody is a true angel. You know? So you have to do it, right? Okay? That's all. That's all. Do you guys have any questions? You know, some people like to ask us about channels and emptiness. Oh, by the way, the point about this is your body and the pen are the same. If you have good seeds in your mind, you see it as a pen. If you have lower seeds in your mind, you see it as something to chew on. Which is, you see? So if you have good seeds in your mind, you see this as flesh and blood. If you work really hard to take care of other people, if you devote your life, all your life, everything you have, to taking care of other people, and not just yourself, then this turns into light. So which one is it really? No, now you know. Which one?
Neither.
Just say neither. That's emptiness, okay? It's not really either one. It just depends on what seeds are in your mind. If you go around planting good seeds, and it can't be half-assed, okay? There's this, what's her name? rock star, feminist rock star, Annie DeFranco. Yeah, I ain't got time for her. How's it going?
I'm not singing.
Anyway, she said, I ain't got time for half. I ain't got time half-ass. You can't be half-ass. If you're half-ass, nothing will change. No, you either go for it or you don't go for it. So you might want to wait. I don't know. But you really got to take care of other people. And you have to really try hard at it. Make it a life's work. You know what I mean? As much work as you put into your everything else you do. Make it your career. And then the body changes. Why? Because it's empty. You see? Because it's neither. So you guys, the next time you hear emptiness, you're going to... What's your name?
Raphael.
You're going to remember Raphael's neither. Okay? No, remember Raphael's neither. We'll call it Raphael's neither. Okay? It's Raphael's neither. Are you made of flesh and blood and devoted to taking care of one person? Or are you made of light and working in many, many places and serving many, many people at the same time? Which one are you, really? We have to say neither, right? No, really, you have to say neither. And then you work on it, right? You plant the seeds. How you see it depends on what seeds you have in your mind. What seeds you have in your mind is 100% depends on did you take care of other people or not. That's all. That's all. So you can ask questions about that. Some people like to grill us about three-year retreat, like what did you eat and how many rattlesnakes did you see and stuff like that. If you have any questions like that, go ahead. If not, we'll just call it a night. Yeah? My lama used to say, oh, you know everything. Okay? Yeah, in the back.
I've got two questions. One, what is the quickest way to work?
Okay. He said, how do you speed this work up? You know? No, and they say it takes three countless eons, right? Countless is a number in Abhidharma cosmology. 10 to the 60th power. 10 with 60 zeros on it is a countless. 3 times 10 to the 60th power times like 5 million years is the normal time it takes. Okay? If you understand this thing clearly and you have a direct experience of it, and if a lama teaches you proper tantra, secret teachings, then one lifetime. And that's the big deal about tantra. That's the big exciting thing, you know? Like, you accelerate the karmic seeds. But you want to accelerate the karma properly, you know, struggle to understand this thing. Think about it every single day. There's a tantric vow. You know, you have to think about this every single day. You have to meditate about this every single day. There's something very important about this. It's the key. And if you give a piece of bread to a sparrow and you don't understand that, you might get some water crackers later in your life. No, really. And if you give a piece of bread to a sparrow and you understand this thing, you could become a tantric deity in that lifetime. You see, that's the answer. It's to understand this thing. And then tantra, which we're going to cover on the weekend, so you got to come on that. Okay? What's your second question? Say again?
Like all the mundane things?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you it's a story. 20 years ago, somebody asked me to go translate for Yeshe Dindin. He's the doctor of the Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama's doctor. And I went to this place in New York City and I translated, and he taught the causes of cancer. And it took him like an hour. And he said all these amazing things. He said, do you want to know? Somebody asked, what causes cancer? And he said, the rubber that wears off of automobile tires is a major cause of cancer. You see, you don't even think about that. You see what I mean? X million cars and the rubber coming off of it in little particles. He said, that's all in the air around you constantly, you know. That rubber is carcinogenic. And then the electromagnetic, he said this. The magnetic field around wiring is carcinogenic. It causes cancer. And then all of the preservatives you use in your food, especially canned food, he said, is all carcinogenic, you know. And obviously the pollution that comes out of cars causes cancer, you know. So, you know, and then we were getting more and more depressed as he went on. We're in, like, Manhattan, right? And, and then finally one guy raises his hand and he says, Dr. Dundon, you know, we're just ordinary people. We're just living in an ordinary place, you know. What can we do? You know, what choice do we have? You know, we're just ordinary people. We're just trying to make it, you know. Now you tell us the whole world is giving us cancer, you know. And if those are the causes of cancer, it's hopeless, you know. And he said, I translated it to him. Then he got angry. And he said, he looked at me like I did something bad, you know. And he said, I didn't say those were the causes. I said, yeah, you said kin. He said, no, not kin, but not gyu, you know. Gyu means cause, kin means factor, you know. So he said, those are kin. I said kin, I didn't say cause. I said, oh, he said factor. So I said, yeah, those are the factors for getting cancer. Well, then what's the gyu, you know, what's the cause? He said, oh, you didn't treat other people nice, you know. That's all. That's the cause of cancer. Of course. I didn't say that. So what's this got to do with your question? He looks at me, he looks at that guy who asked the question, he says, and don't call yourself an ordinary guy. And don't call yourself living in an ordinary place, because you're not, you know. And he got all upset. And he's like, you're not an ordinary person. You made it to Naropa. You made it here. You've been a yogi in countless lifetimes, you know. You are listening to the holiest words in the planet being spoken at this moment, you know. You are hearing the direct instructions for turning into a being who can serve countless people. You ain't no ordinary person. I don't want you calling yourself ordinary, you know. And then he'd say, and the ordinary decisions are not ordinary, you know. When you put on a shirt, when you choose which shirt to put on, well, which one will I wear when I'm an angel? You see what I mean? You see what I mean? Like, is the angel putting on a blue shirt or a red shirt today? You know what I mean? So people will see her, you know, as an angel, you see. And should she be walking down the street, you know, or should she be driving that car? You know what I mean? And every decision has to be from the point of view of when my body changes. You know, if my body changed this morning, how should people see me now? You see what I mean? Then you dress that way. And in Tantra, you might wear your hair as an angel or wear jewelry or... You see, that's the reason. So every time you make a mundane decision, you make it on this holy, sacred basis of you're thinking, you know, what will she wear today? This angel who's going to save everybody. And then you put all these good seeds in your mind. And one day they wake up and you wake up like Franz Kafka and the roach thing. And you're like, no, all those seeds open. You see? So that's all. Nothing mundane. Mundane things become sacred. You still have to decide which shirt to put on, right? But it's a totally different decision, right? Any others? Maybe we stop there. It's very auspicious, I think, about that. So I'd just like to thank you for having us. I mean, I wheedled my way into Naropa because it's such a... You have such an amazing karma to be here. You have no idea, you know, and you should appreciate it. And you know, you made the best career choice of anybody when you came here. And... you have all those seeds are being poured in your mind by Trungpa Rinpoche and all those lineage holders. And see your teachers who have studied with Rinpoche or been affected by Rinpoche. Don't think they're normal people, okay? You're not a normal yogi. You've been doing it tens of thousands of lifetimes. And whatever teacher you have here who doesn't wear a red suit and they don't have slanty eyes, they just look like a plain old American, they're not, you know? They have this blessing. They have been touched by Rinpoche. No mistakes. And you have studied with them for many lifetimes, you know. So honor them and understand what opportunity you have, you know. Some huge connection that you've had for many lives. Don't think, oh, I got to leave. It's 3:15. I got to get to Psych 103, you know. It's not like that, you know. You are in the presence of people who have taught you for thousands of lifetimes, you know, and appreciate what you have, okay? It's a very beautiful thing. This place, the fact that it exists, is unbelievable. Okay, so you are in a mandala. You're not in some building, right? Okay. We'll do a special Tibetan thing where you give away the good karma. Okay? So we made good karma tonight. Big time. Big good karma. We talked about the only important thing in the world, really. Okay? So if you know the mandala gesture, do that. If you don't, just do this. Okay? And we'll do a little Tibetan prayer. And just imagine all that good karma is, you're giving it away. If you get angry tonight, all the good karma gets wiped out. If you give it away now, you put it in the bank, karmic bank. Then you can get angry and it's just new bad karma. Okay? But you're not wiping out your old good karma. No, really. Seriously. Okay? So give the karma. Imagine the karma going out and helping many, many people in this state, in this world. Many worlds. Okay? And Pelmala, loud. Okay?
Shi pu ki jo shi me to tam ri ra bing shi lin de kyam pa di sang ge shin du vin te u wa di ro ku nam ta shing la che pa shu idam guru jananda kamriyata yahi dikhe wo khun sanamishe to to shin sanamishe ne chune dampa kuni